Dateline Washington, senior abomination. Officials said today that airstrikes against the Islamic State carried out in Syria without seeking the permission of the Syrian government or the United Nations Security Council were legal because they were done in defense of Iraq. Think about that. America goes in and invades Iraq. We attack Iraq. We take Iraq away from Saddam Hussein. Yeah, so we invade Iraq, we attack Iraq, and then we say of the new Iraq government that we have ushered in that we're legal in bombing Syria to protect the Iraq that we broke. That's how convoluted our reasoning has become. That is so grotesquely absurd that the only thing you can do is to laugh. And yet what we're laughing at here is carnage, bombing, and killing. You know, the United States is now the world's leading merchant of death. And we're justifying this, the most recent invasion of another country, because we're in defense of a country that we were opposed to and attacked and invaded just a decade prior. Now, of course, the notion that an invasion and airstrikes over a country that has done nothing wrong to America, there's nothing that the Syrian government has done that's been opposed to America, makes the whole thing counterproductive. But I want you to think about this, the duplicity of it. The justification for bombing Syria wasn't the defense of the Iraqi government, which is a group of Shiite religious zealots. No. Remember how every politician, including the abominator, including Senator John McClown, all justified bombing Syria? It was because ISIS was a real and present danger to America, that ISIS was a great threat to America, and that we have to invade and bomb Syria because ISIS is a threat to America, therefore we're defending America. Now, mind you, ISIS wasn't a threat to America. ISIS hadn't threatened America. ISIS has not carried out a single mission in America. But that was the justification, at least to Americans. And now we're saying, oh, well, that really isn't true. No. We're not here to protect. We're not using the American military to protect Americans because that would be laughable. No. We're using the American military to defend the Iraqi government. But why on earth would you do that? There's this whole myth that the U.S. military, that we should salute them, we should honor them, we should show our gratitude to them because they're keeping America free. Well, if you're defending the Iraqi government, you sure as hell ain't keeping America free. I mean, the duplicity here, no matter which way you look at this, you need to either laugh or cry. That means that the ruse that the American military is defending America and keeping it free is a complete another lie. There are no American interests in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Vietnam, in Korea. There's no keeping America free from the Islamic State if you're bombing to defend Iraq. Boy. And yet, do you think the journalist who wrote this article, the CBS News, is capable of saying, wait a minute, that's inconsistent with what all the American politicians told the American people, and why would the American military be engaged fighting for another country? Particularly one that has been so ruthless, so brutal towards its own people. Why is that an appropriate use of the United States military? Do the American taxpayer think that it's our responsibility to build a military that can be deployed defending foreign countries? You know, if this was actually a democracy, how do you think the people would vote in that regard? International law generally prohibits using force on sovereign territory of another country without its permission or authorization from the United Nations, except as a matter of self-defense. Oops. But we aren't defending ourselves. We can't claim self-defense. So we're in violation of international law. But international law never applies to the United States. No, we think of ourselves as above it all. American intelligence agencies, that was an oxymoron, have concluded that the United States, that the Islamic State poses no immediate threat to the United States. And that's true. The CIA, the NSA, and the FBI collectively have all written position papers that conclude that the Islamic State poses no threat to the United States. Sorry, no threat. So we can't claim self-defense. So all of this rhetoric trying to get Americans to rally around the flag and support the president at a time of war is make-believe. It's poppycock. It's political propaganda. It's presidents wanting to be wartime presidents because they're more popular. Fewer people are willing to speak against them. And it's admirals and generals wanting to go to war because that's how their careers are honed. Though they believe that another militant group targeted in the strikes, the Khorasan group, does pose a threat. Oh, yeah, right. They're part of the al-Nusra Front. They're hunkered down outside of Aleppo. No matter what they do in Aleppo, there is a 0% possibility that out of the suburbs of Aleppo, a twisted heap of ruin, that they're a threat to anyone other than themselves. But the senior administration official said on Tuesday that Iraq had a valid right of self-defense against the Islamic State. Why? Did they have a valid right? I don't think so, by the way. No, in fact, I'm convinced they don't. And that is because they attacked using the U.S.-supplied military and weapons, using tanks, artillery, and attack helicopters. They bombarded Fallujah. And that is what led to this war. They started it. They don't have a right to defense. They started the war. They are the aggressors. They are not the defenders. Let's tell the truth. Because the military group was attacking Iraq from its havens in Syria. It's not true either. They don't have havens in Syria. In Syria, the Islamic State is attacking the Assad regime, and successfully. And in Iraq, the Islamic State, via the Awakening Program, is attacking Shiite positions. And so, even in Iraq, it's a civil war, just as it is in Syria. You have two civil wars, both fought on the same premise, Sunni via Shia, and the oppression that one brings upon the other. And so it's not a case of Syrian ISIS going into Iraq to attack Iraqis. When the Islamic State acts in Iraq, most of the actors are Iraqis. Iraq asked the United States for assistance in defending itself, making the strikes legal. officials said. No, they're not. Not only aren't they legal, they're immoral. Not only are they immoral, they're suicidal. They're counterproductive. They will achieve exactly the opposite of the intended result. There is an article that just hit the news wires that says, in essence, that the United States and its allies, as they have begun the Syrian war, recognize that it's going to be a multi-year long campaign. Years. As I said, it's easy to engage in a war. America engaged in a war two nights ago. Easy to start one. Tough to get out. And now they're saying, well, we're going to be at this for years. It gives us a chance to justify our war machine, to exercise our killing apparatus. But what do you think is going to happen 3 years from now? America is still bombing in Syria. What's going to happen? How is the world going to be better as a result of that? I want to turn briefly to CNN story that appeared yesterday. This was the one that had the picture that was so grim that still haunts my soul. It's a picture where there is the orange metal and plastic infused fencing that you see around, you know, construction sites in the United States, and it's surrounding a community in Liberia. And the people on the other side of the fencing are wearing ski goggles. They're wearing what you would consider to be a rain suit, a yellow rain suit. They've got kitchen gloves, and they are breathing through a respirator air filtering device. And they look as if, you know, they're monsters. They look as if they're... We're dealing with the future, and we've got a quarantine of gargantuan proportions for humankind, and that these are death camps, and that everyone in the camp is destined to die. That's the image. It's haunting. And we're going to talk about an individual story within it. Dateline is Liberia. The community is Monrovia. A young boy wanders through the high grass. He looks lost. He's already lost 13 of his relatives, his parents among them. They were all killed by Ebola. So far, at least 1,600 people have died from Ebola in Liberia alone. The country has seen a 52% increase in cases in just the past 3 weeks. That's in large part because there's no outside medical help for residents who get sick there. That is their explanation. No, it's not that the disease is deadly. It's not that people are responding to the disease in a manner that is expected, but not actually moral. You know, when someone comes down with a disease, our natural inclination is to try to heal them, to try to save them. And it's true that 30% of Ebola patients survive. But those who treat them often die. And it is the 70% who die and those who are around them that are then affected, who then affect others. There are times, and Ebola is a great example, where the most humane thing is to have those who are infected quarantined and eradicated. Their bodies either burned or are buried. But the hosts of Ebola are people. And those people are deadly. And if those people are allowed to live uninterrupted, unquarantined, then far more people get sick and die. The most merciful thing in the case of Ebola is to recognize that the host, people infected with the disease, need to be quarantined, be allowed to die. I share this for the two reasons we've talked about recently. One is that there are those who moronically claim that the Torah is similar to the Quran in its fixation on killing, and it's not remotely true. But it's important to recognize that when Yahweh said that the inequity of those living in the promised land had reached a point where there was no hope for them, they were diseased beyond salvation, that there was no cure for what ailed them, that they needed to be quarantined, removed from the home of the chosen people before the chosen people occupied that home. It was the most humane thing to do, the most compassionate thing to do. And as deadly and as horrific as Ebola is, religion is far more deadly, far more horrific. You know, Ebola doesn't seek to inflict pain. It doesn't seek to behead or to cause great suffering. Certainly there is suffering, but that's not its purpose. And yet the purpose of an Islamic jihadist is not just to impose their religion through violence means, through convert or die, but to be ruthless, to emulate their prophet and God. And it's a disease that there is no cure. Words wielded wisely won't resonate in the mind of someone who is infected by Islam. It's just like medications don't resolve the problem of someone infected with Ebola. And the homes of those with people affected by Ebola remain unsafe, just as homes would have been in the Promised Land had those who were ravaged by the disease of religion remained. Today, the most deadly pathogen on earth is Islam. Kills more people than any other disease. It is the most savage, the most ruthless, the most deadly of all infections affecting humankind. The only merciful approach to it is to declare war on it, to make it illegal, to quarantine it, to allow them to kill one another if they wish to, but not to affect or kill anyone outside of their group. We had a Facebook contact, not to me, I don't use Facebook, but to our self-proclaimed genius, the producer of Shattering Myths, Scott.
Borderline expert.
Oh, yeah, and we've added a new category because he does produce a new show, which does make him a borderline expert.
Borderline expert, yeah.
Wanting to know how it was possible for Franklin Graham and Samaritan's Purse to break U.S. law and bring a person into America with not one but two people into America that were infected with Ebola. And the answer is that they got State Department approval. And the reason they got State Department approval is that's what the State Department wanted to do. The State Department wanted to engage the Centers for Disease Control. And we know that because once Samaritan's Purse funded that first flight, that since that time, there have been flights almost every day, if not every day, bringing infected Ebola victims back into the United States. So it's what the State Department of Obama Nation wanted to do. It's not that we're trying to keep the disease over there. We're bringing it right here. That's the answer to the question. Moving back to the story. In Monrovia, the country's crowded capital, doors to hospitals and clinics are shut tight, locked with thick padlocks. Well, why would you lock the hospitals and clinics? Would that not be the most humane place to congregate those infected with Ebola? But no, they're locked. Many healthcare workers in West Africa have lost their lives due to the way the virus spreads, through contact with bodily fluids of those who are infected. On Monday, the World Health Organization urged the affected countries to give healthcare workers both the adequate security and safety equipment they need, as well as appropriate education and training on infection control. You know, if you're in Africa and you have a healthcare system and your healthcare workers are not trained on the way that Ebola transmits from one person to another, maybe you've got a real leadership problem there. That's beyond stupid. And then once you have an outbreak, and it's now many months old, you'd think that that problem of letting people know that it's bodily fluids and contact with an infected person that spreads the disease, you'd think they'd get that. A new Ebola clinic opened in Monrovia this week, but bodies lay on the ground outside its walls. Ambulances filled with Ebola patients, some that have traveled 7 hours to get there, are not unloaded. Without help to get them inside, the patients fall in the dirt, mere feet away from treatment. Even that's incorrect. They're not treated in the hospital. It's a congregated place to allow them to die. And can you imagine that you open up a new clinic and that surrounding the new clinic are just dead bodies all around the clinic? In other words, it's rather than being a place to concentrate and quarantine the virus, it's a place to spread the virus. All the money spent on the clinic was counterproductive. Without help, family members must now care for their own Ebola patients. And without the proper safety equipment, they contract the disease and it continues to spread. And that's what's happening in Liberia. The hospitals and clinics are shuttered. They're littered with dead bodies inside and out. And so those infected with Ebola stay at home. And family members treat them. And so husbands are infected by wives, wives infected by husbands, children are infected by their parents, and the disease continues to spread. We're unwilling to recognize that it has to be quarantined. Dressed from head to toe in protective suits and thick goggles, the burial teams attempt to stay safe, but nothing can shield them from the unspeakable horrors that they witness as they make their rounds. One described a home that he had entered over this weekend. He said, "I took the key and opened the door, and I went inside, and I saw a six-month-old child sucking on its mother's skin. The mother was laying on its stomach. She had died from Ebola. The baby was searching for the mother's milk." He said, "Right away, I started shedding tears." WHO said on Monday that the overall death toll in the Ebola outbreak has risen to 2,800 in five countries, the heart of the epidemic: Sierra Leone, Liberia, Guinea, Nigeria, and Senegal. Of course, there is a new outbreak in the Congo as well. and that those numbers are expected by the end of this month, or I should say the end of October, to be in the range of 20,000. And they're saying that the possibility exists that by the end of January, the number infected could be 1.4 million. Tears your heart out. The latest figures suggest that 70% of those infected with Ebola in West Africa have died, higher than previously reported. Yeah, the original numbers were closer to between 50 and 60%. The lower the fatality, actually, the worse the situation is, because with a, historically, Ebola has killed between 90 and 95% of those infected. But the fact that some 30% of Ebola victims survive, there is hope for them, and therefore family members will continue to try to nurse the Ebola victim back to health because there's a 30% chance they will survive. But in so doing, they expose themselves to Ebola, which is why the disease continues to contaminate others. And so if it were a absolute death sentence, if it were 95% die, then the human instinct to try to rescue and save and cure the infected person would give way to the certainty that they're going to die and that it would be counterproductive to do so. But because 30% survive, now there's the tendency to try to nurse them back to health, where the one providing the care, typically a family member, is now exposed, and the cycle repeats itself. President Barack Obama spoke at the United Nations today. His theme was the same as his theme back years ago, when following the killing of four Americans in Benghazi, he lashed out at what he conceived to be the heart of darkness, which was extremism. And in that speech, years ago now, he blamed extremism for the deaths of those Americans. He concocted a whole story about how an extremist Christian movie led to the deaths of those Americans, and that we as a nation must speak out against extremism. That was all a lie. It's what the president wants. He wants to be opposed to anybody who holds a different view than his own. And if you hold a different view than that articulated by liberal, politically correct socialists, then you are an extremist. And so everyone can be labeled an enemy of the state if they oppose the more popular stance, which is secularism, humanism, socialism, political correctness. If you're not in that camp, you are an extremist. And so the nation is establishing its turf. It's the empowered against the extremists. It's why the nation has an NSA search capability where the enemy are the American people. They're the ones being investigated. And any view that is opposed to the status quo, which is socialist secular humanism, the national religion of America, is considered extremist and an enemy of the state. Well, he returned to that exact same thing. He got away with it because most Americans are dumber than stones, are ignorant, are irrational, don't give a damn, frankly, that the President of the United States speaks the truth or lies, that America is engaged in yet another war, that the military is counterproductive. I don't care. I don't care that politicians on both sides of the aisles are lying through their teeth. They just don't care. And so he gets by with a lie. He was reelected after the lie and after it was obvious that he lied several years ago. And so he's right back in the same venue, the United Nations, attacking extremism, not Islam. He told the UN General Assembly the world had not confronted the intolerance, sectarianism, and hopelessness that feeds extremism. See, tolerance is considered the ultimate virtue in political correctness. So intolerance is considered a foe. Now, if you're intolerant of that which is deadly, like Islam, you're actually merciful, but not according to political correctness. In political correctness, you need to be tolerant of the merciless. Now, which is, in fact, aiding and abetting the merciless. You know, at the University of Virginia, that's, they had the rally where they said, we're intolerant of intolerance. So it's going to be the second best public academic institution in the United States, if not the world. And yet the product has been so dumbed down that they hold signs that say we're intolerant of intolerance, and they can't even see the hypocrisy in their own slogans. We'll be back. Yes, the Abominator told the General Assembly the same thing that he tried to convey 3 years ago. That the world had not confronted and needed to confront. It had to be intolerant of, therefore, intolerance. He's as dumb as the University of Virginia students holding up the placard. That the world had not confronted intolerance, therefore, it must be intolerant of intolerance. And how do they define intolerance? As anyone who is intolerant of them? That's their definition. What's an extremist? Someone who holds a view that is out of sync with their own. And what is their own? Well, if you're an elected, empowered person in America, you are a secular humanist. You are a socialist. You're into wealth redistribution. You're into environmentalism. You're into the myth of man-made global warming and the recipe being redistribution of wealth from countries that are productive to countries that are not. You are opposed to religion unless those religions are opposed to Christianity, in which case you embrace them. You want to confront intolerance, but doesn't that make you intolerant? How could you be a foe of intolerance and confront intolerance without becoming intolerant? Oh, great leader. He then says the second great foe is sectarianism. Why doesn't he just say Islam? Where on earth is there a problem today as a result of Christianity? I mean, sure, Christians are idiots. But where are they killing people? Where's the menace of Christianity? Where's the menace of Buddhism? Yeah, some Buddhists burn themselves up. There's very few of them. Yes, occasionally in India, the lower castes of Hindus abuse little girls, and it's disgusting. But where is the threat from, apart from their own, of Hinduism? The problem isn't sectarianism. The problem is Islam. It's only the Islamic religion that is menacing today. There's no other religion that's menacing. I mean, there was a time where secular humanism was the most menacing religion, when Adolf Hitler and Stalin and Mao, Pol Pot, were ravaging humankind by the tens of millions. But today, the only sectarian foe is Islam. And since that's obvious, why not say it? I mean, sectarian speaks of religious. There's only one deadly religion today. There's only one religion promoting terrorist acts today. Only one. And they're promoting all of them. Thousands of them. Why not say so? What do you got against speaking the truth? His next item was hopelessness. What he's trying to say is two things with hopelessness. One is that he is the great provider of hope, because he wants to be perceived as the Messiah of the world. And second, that the idea of hope is conveyed with wealth redistribution. If you have more welfare, more food stamps, greater social securities, total socialized medicine, if you redistribute American assets overseas, then that is the sign of hope. But what he doesn't realize here, or what he's trying to somehow corrupt, is the realization that America has engaged to displace hopelessness with weapons. We've given those who are downtrodden weapons so that they can lash out. We gave the Sunnis in Syria hope with each gun. We gave the awakening Sunni Muslims who were being oppressed in the Shiite Iraq that we created hope with their weapons. That's not hope. And why is it that in these areas of the world where war has become commonplace, which is the land of Islam, is there so much hopelessness? If Islam's not to blame, why are all these wars in Islamic countries? Why is all the poverty in Islamic countries? Why are so many Muslims hopeless?